Torkilden, Saturday, 6th December, 1980. I would like today for all of us to consider together a subject which will appeal to every heart, the subject of happiness. All the world suffers from a peculiar superstition. And the superstition is simply this, that to live the religious life means to be miserable. How that superstition came about is not difficult to see, because people fight shy of the fact of existence, that as we grow up from childhood to adolescence, then to adulthood, and then approach middle age and old age, changes take place. And there's a very strong tendency for people not to accept change. They do not realize that no growth is possible unless there is change. And change means literally the death of that which is actually present at the moment. When that which is actually present at the moment has grown, become forcibly changed into the new, advanced and more advanced state, then the old state has died. And the more completely it dies, the more valuable is the growth that has taken place. People don't realize that. They like to stay put where they are, to be secure, as they call it, being quite ignorant of the fact that there's no such thing as absolute security anywhere in the universe. Now, if people experience a certain state of life, whatever their age may be, in which they feel that, oh, we are secure now, things are all right, we can get along, and if nothing drastic happens, this is what I would like to have for the rest of my days, which is quite absurd. That is quite the wrong conception of security. Another point is that practically all human beings, with very few exceptions, literally very few exceptions, have quite a mistaken conception of happiness. They regard happiness as the experiencing of sensational excitement with its accompanying sensuous delights. I say sensuous rather than sensual, because all this applies to the functioning and experiencing of all the senses at work and whatsoever they bring to us. So that whole field is the field of sensuousness. And they associate, therefore, happiness with sensuous delight. And they plan for it, and they long to repeat it over and over again. Now, this is where all humanity constantly makes a mistake. When the deep teachings of religion come along and point out to a human being, we are not really human, to us subhuman beings, and when the deep teachings of religion come along and point out to us that there is a way of life by which we free ourselves from thraldom to sensuous excitement and delight. That freedom enables us to experience a profounder mode of awareness of our existence, of what we actually are, of our relationship to all other human beings and to the world in which we live, and we begin to taste joy or happiness, if you like to use that word, in a much profounder sense, commensurate with the fact that as we grow older, we are changing into something different and something which can be better, a change which is progressive, not regressive, or just a fortuitous change which has no special significance or value for anybody. Now that the great religious teachers, the founders of the religions, explicitly declared that they were concerned with man's happiness, the happiness of all mankind. And if one goes into the deeps of religious teaching, one sees quite clearly that they had a very clear vision of what the meaning of human happiness. Human happiness to them meant human fruition. And these are words which we, as we are, use in our mistaken way. Our fruition or our well-being, as we call it. But they understood exactly what human well-being meant and how human well-being can be released into our lives through perceiving the truths of ourself, of existence, our relationship to it, and bringing it about in our everyday life. Let me just quote from various religious texts. First of all, let us hear what Kashyapa, the son of Marichi, one of the great poet seers of the Rig Veda, wrote. He said, "Make me immortal in that realm of eager wish and strong desire, the region of the golden sun, where food and full delight are found." Now, we have to be careful in reading this sort of thing, these translations from the original Vedic. In that realm of eager wish and strong desire. But a person in the world will say, well, I am full of eager wishes and strong desires and so forth, and I haven't found immortality or happiness thereby. The eager wish and strong desire spoken of here refers to the passionate aspiration towards true human fulfillment, always bearing in mind the true meaning of the word human, the blissful creator. Don't forget that. The blissful creator is the true human being. The word human means precisely that. So, eager wish and strong desire has to be related to that passionate aspiration for the highest, for the supreme, and not the ordinary worldly passions and whims and fancies and pursuits and so forth, which drag us down into the mire literally. The region of the golden sun, the golden sun referred to here, is the supreme state of consciousness, the supreme state of awareness of existence. We are all aware of existence in our own limited way, in our own self-centered, self-oriented way. And that way, because we are aware of our existence in that way, we are in the state of conflict, because being self-centered, there is we set up in opposition the not-self, as we call it, and this is one of the main roots of conflict and sorrow in our lives. So the region of the golden sun means that state of awareness of existence, which is the utterly purified state, the complete state, the state in which the psyche offers no obstruction whatever to the free inflow and expression of transcendence in us and the outflow of transcendent energy through us to our environment and surroundings. Then he goes on, "Make me immortal in that realm where happiness and transports, where joys and felicities combine and longing wishes are fulfilled." Now, these transports refer, of course, to that extraordinary state of bliss, of a peaceful peaceful bliss which is associated with the with one's state of consciousness when one has freed the psyche from all imperfection. Then everything in the world, the very next object, the very next person, the very next event or situation is one in which the perfected Holy One inevitably experiences the bliss of realization of the fact and the truth of the actual situation or experience. So those are the last few verses of that hymn in the Rig Veda. It's in the 9th book, the 113th hymn, verses 7 to 11. It's one of the most wonderful hymns of the Rig Veda, provided you understand it. Don't understand it like the clever scholar understands it and says, oh, these old Rig Vedic teachers were hedonists. They weren't hedonists by a long chalk. They knew that the relinquishment of clinging to that which belongs to the realm of the mortal means the relinquishment of sorrow and suffering. They knew that. Then there's another hymn by the Rishi. Rishi means the singer, a singer of the song of eternal life. That is the true meaning of Rishi, not somebody who gets up on a stage and gives you a pop performance of some sort. The Rishi Brihaddeva. Brihad means expanded or expansion, and Deva means light. So that is the pseudonym which that Holy One uses for himself. He declares, Brihaddeva, the foremost of light winners, winner of the light, repeats these holy prayers, this strength to Indra. He rules the great self-luminous fold of light, and all the doors of light hath he thrown open. Then, in the Upanishads, in the Chandogya Upanishad, when the disciple Narada asks his teacher Sanat Kumara to expound the nature of the Atma, Sanat Kumara has a long discourse with him, and towards the end of it he says, where there is the infinite, there is joy. There is no joy in the finite. Only in the infinite there is joy. Know the nature of the infinite. And then he goes on talking about the nature of the infinite and so forth. Now, there is a remarkable significance to this. To know the infinite means to be conscious in such a manner, to be superconscious, in fact, or supra-conscious, if you like to use that word, to be supra-conscious in such a manner that one is aware of existence as a unitary whole, as one great totality, although our senses convey to us only the innumerable, the multitudinous, separate things, people, events and so on, which we experience. We experience existence in terms of separateness. But if the psyche is utterly purified, then universal mind functions freely through this purified psyche, and one is aware of the one total reality as a whole, as the fundamental background, the basis through which we experience all the separate objects through the use of our senses. our senses, and particularly our brain, analyze the one whole into innumerable separate parts. The brain synthesizes these, and that is especially the task of the left side of the brain. The right side of the brain integrates later on in life all that we have gathered through the left side of the brain. It is not a synthesizer. John Moore uses the word synthesizer for the right side also. I think integrator would be a better word for this reason. Synthesizing applies principally in our everyday experience in life to a mechanical putting together, a mechanical joining together. If you get hold of all the parts which make up a motor car, say, and put them together in the right way, then you have synthesized all those items and produced one motor car. It's a mechanical thing, and it applies in the realm of that which, because it is put together, will also be taken apart. It belongs to the realm of the finite and the mortal. Synthesis is specifically there. The brain synthesizes the sense impressions. The sense impressions attempt to tell us the nature of the universe in which we live and the nature of our relationships with people and with our surrounding. And then the senses convey all those impressions to us, and the left side of the brain synthesizes these, and out of that synthesis, all our concepts and our knowledge, as we call it, and so on, are formed. But they all belong to the realm of the finite, and we live our lives in terms of that kind of consciousness, of the consciousness of finitude, of mortality, of temporality, and therefore the realm of sorrow and suffering. And this sorrow and suffering and the use of the senses also implies deliberate pursuit of sense pleasures. We may, of course, have rather more elevated types of sense pleasure, art and science and philosophy and intellectual discourse and all that kind of thing. But it is all mortal, it is all temporal, it fades away, it dies. It is not the true infinite. Only when there is the utter purity, one's consciousness is able to be in tune, complete attunement with the one primordial creative energy. And in that there is the attunement with that which is the infinite as such. It's an extraordinary thing, really. In our own lives, sometimes we do experience that, but not everybody recognizes that this is it. One cannot recognize it when it is happening, because description belongs to the realm of the finite, to the realm of the analyzed and the separate, not to the realm of totality and the whole. Description belongs to the realm of death, not to the realm of deathlessness. But there is that state of awareness in which deathlessness is realized. So that's what Brihadeva says. Now, listen to the Buddha's assurance. He's talking with a Brahmin called Pottapada, who came asking questions on various matters. And the Buddha answers them, and seeing that Pottapada is really earnest, he reveals to Pottapada the way, the Noble Eightfold Way, as he called it, by which enlightenment can be realized, and which leads to nirvana, ultimately. So, in this discourse, towards the end, he says, "Now it may be, Pottapada, that you think evil dispositions may be put away, the dispositions that tend to purification may increase, one may continue to see face to face, and by himself come to realize the full perfection and grandeur of wisdom, but one may continue sad. Now that, says the Buddha, O Pottapada, would not be accurate judgment. When such conditions are fulfilled, then there will be joy and happiness and peace, and in continual mindfulness and self-mastery, one will dwell at ease. That's a lovely expression. It is so matter-of-fact, it is so ordinary, to dwell at ease, dwell in true comfort. In true comfort, in the true state of strength, the full strength of the soul, virtue. Virtus means the strength of the soul. And that is the state of comfort, and that strength is a strength which is characterized above all by infinite resilience. It's not the strength that fights against anything, that imposes its will upon a situation or a person or whatever it may be. It is infinite resilience, and that infinite resilience can never be overcome by anyone who opposes it. You can't oppose infinite resilience. Then we come to this statement in connection with happiness. First, with respect to individual happiness, for the individual person who lives the religious life, Zarathustra declares, "He who expounds to the wise," it's rather interesting, "he who expounds to the wise," why he selected out the wise and left the rest out, I don't know, but there we are. "He who expounds to the wise the holy word is indeed blessed, blessed with supreme joy." These are quotations, this is a quotation from one of the scriptures. These volumes here are the scriptures which are the Zarathustrian scriptures, these three and also that one. Now, the Buddha said, shortly after the beginning of his ministry, when he was 35, and towards the end of his life, he addressed the bhikkhus and said, "Therefore, O bhikkhus, ye to whom the truths I have perceived have been made known by me, having thoroughly made yourselves masters of them, practice them, meditate upon them, and spread them abroad, in order that pure religion may last long and be perpetuated, in order that it may continue to be for the good and happiness of the great multitudes, out of pity for the world, to the good and the gain and the weal of devas and men." For the happiness of the many folk. So you see, in all these affirmations, we observe that the great teachers were concerned with our happiness and our fulfillment in the true sense. Something which belongs to the realm of the immortal, not of the mortal, the passing pleasures and excitements which people seek and through which they so often ruin their health and well-being and squander their wealth and all the rest of it. But of all the affirmations of happiness and joy, I think that the Zarathustrian scriptures have perhaps the most optimistic presentation of all. Now, in the Zarathustrian prayers, particularly in the gathas, you will find Zarathustra teaching the people this. He prays to Ahura Mazda. Ahura Mazda is the name for God in Zarathustrian religion. Meaning, Ahura means Lord of life, and Mazda means Lord of wisdom. O Lord of life and wisdom is the first and fundamental meaning of the name Ahura Mazda. Raise up the life of man to the height of bliss, O Mazda, through Vahu Mana. Vahu Mana means the good mind. The good in the sense of the absolute good, not the relative good, which is the opposite of evil. Through Vahu Mana, Mana, as you appreciate, is mind, manas in India. Kshatra, which means the creative energy, which is the through which Ahura Mazda brings forth the universe. That is his kshatra, his power, his absolute power. And Asha. Asha is righteousness, purity, holiness. And the law of Asha is the law of living the good life for all Zarathustrians. Then another statement. O Lord of life, for my joy and far-reaching vision, reveal unto me thy incomparable gifts of kshatra, which are the blessings of the good mind, the absolutely good mind. Then again, for whom, he asks Ahura, O Ahura, for whom didst thou fashion this abundant, joy-giving creation? He calls the whole creation joy-giving. Now there is a great secret involved. We'll talk about that in a moment. And he goes on, how may I walk in beatific joy, hand in hand with you, O Mazda, and be your intimate companion? Then in another one of the gathas, he says, through the Holy Spirit, thou art indeed he who molded this joyous creation for man's sake. It's very interesting that the Lord molded this joyous creation for man's sake. And then in the first of the great gathas, there are five in all, there is an extraordinary and wonderful redemptive promise for good doers and evil doers alike. I don't think in any other religion you get quite this sort of statement. Not quite this, you get similar, something approaching this. He says, so understand, O mortal men, the decrees which Mazda has ordained regarding happiness and misery. There will be a long period of suffering for the wicked and rewards for the pious. But thereafter, eternal joy shall reign everywhere. Now that's an extraordinary statement altogether. I haven't come across it in any of the scriptures of the world, but just this one mention. And thereafter, after the dualistic experience of joy and suffering through right doing and wrong doing, after all that, there is eternal joy everywhere. It's one of the most powerful statements regarding joy, regarding happiness, that I have come across in the scriptures. Now, Zarathustra also tells us, how is true happiness to be attained? What is true happiness? There is a very short prayer, which we, those of us who are born Parsis and Zarathustrians, learn. It runs thus, virtue is the supreme good, the only true happiness, the happiness that emerges out of him who is foremost in virtue for the sake of the supreme virtue. And the supreme virtue is the creative power of God himself, because God is the absolute good. Indeed, it is only the good man who is the happy man, and only the happy man who is the good man. It's quite a remarkable little prayer. So we come to consider, how does one live the virtuous life? What sort of a life do we lead? Is it a truly virtuous life? Or is it apparently so? Or actually not so? Our ideas of virtue are based dualistically. Virtue as the opposite of vice. And we associate virtue with that which is pleasant, and vice with that which is unpleasant. If something is harmful to ourselves or to other people, we call it a vice. Cruelty, deceit, dishonesty, and all that sort of thing. We call them vices, and rightly so. They are defilements of the psyche, as the Buddha used to teach. And virtues are regarded by us as the opposite of those. Harmlessness, truthfulness, loving kindness, abstention from all evil, and so forth. The value of presenting virtue in the negative form of abstention from the opposite vice is psychologically very sound. We don't know what the real good is. We think we do. And our criterion always is, what do I as the human being gain by it? How do I improve myself by it? What happiness or pleasure does it give me? That is our criterion deep down in our psyche. We don't live virtuously entirely for virtue's sake, which would mean to live virtuously because virtue is the absolute fact of our existence and of our nature, of our real nature. But we don't see that and we don't accept that. It means sometimes accepting a certain amount and at other times a great deal, not a certain amount, but a great deal of pain and misery and suffering. And we are not prepared to accept that. So our concept of virtue is a very limited concept as such. Nevertheless, although a limited concept, it is like a still photograph, or it is like the shadow of the living reality of virtue in itself. But virtue really, as I said earlier, is the strength of the soul. Now the strength of the soul, the strength of the mind. Man, the root from which the word man comes and mind comes, is the Sanskrit man, meaning not merely to think, in our sense of the word thinking. Our sense of the word thinking is extremely limited. It is just a series of words spoken silently, of ideas, concepts, of plans, of various considerations. And if we observe our thinking process as such, we will see that it is extraordinarily self-oriented. And it is self-concerned, something for our gain and for our pleasure and for our possession, to satisfy our desires or whims or fancies or beliefs or whatever it is. But that kind of desire, the desire for the self, whether it be at an exalted level or at an ordinary low level as such, is the desire which separates us from the rest of existence. It is something which produces division between myself and the rest of the world. And therefore, it is the root source of conflict. All desire for the self, that kind of desire. There is the other aspect of desire, the passionate aspiration for the truth to come to life within us and to function freely. Now, the truth comes to life in us only when we become fully awake to the fact that actually we are extraordinarily self-centered and self-concerned. We do things, we study things, we work for things because we believe that we will be happy. We want a reward all the time. And let us not deceive ourselves that we are free of that we are truly selfless. We may be unselfish to a certain extent. And that happens because we define unselfishness as the opposite of selfishness. And we know that selfishness means to do things for yourself even at the expense of others. And in fact, all too often it is at the expense of others. But selflessness is a totally different thing from unselfishness. Selflessness comes into being when we have fully seen, clearly seen, the nature of selfness, that is self-concernedness, self-orientedness. And when we really see that and see how it functions in our everyday life and affects our surroundings and other people around us, then when we really see that, the psyche naturally gives up that state of selfness. Selfness, as any other evil as such, disappears naturally. How and why? Because all these things are expressions of our psychical energy. The wrong expression of our psychical energy is a vice. And the right expression, the beautiful, the perfect expression, is a virtue in the real sense of the word. So when we see the nature of the evil thing very, very clearly and see that that is part of our own constitution, then that clear-sightedness enables that vice to fall off like a scab falls off after you've had a wound or some such thing and the skin heals. We can't fight against vice or evil. We do that, we do attempt to do that, and the result is only conflict, confusion, difficulty in the long run. We must not fight against these things. We have to understand, and in clear understanding and in clearly seeing the fact as the fact, then the truth is there. When you see the fact as the fact, the truth is there, and the truth does not counteract or produce a palliative as far as the evil is concerned, but it heals that wrong expression of the psychical energy. It's the healing of the psychical energy in ourselves which is the important thing. And therefore we remain free from any conflict in connection with all this. Which means, of course, that we have to utilize our power for salvation, our power for attentiveness, constant and intense attentiveness to all that is taking place in our thoughts and feelings, our actions, and in whatsoever happens in our life and in our circumstance. We have to attend to that very clearly. In that attentiveness, that state of consciousness which is capable of being completely at one with truth, with reality, lights up That is the enlightened state, and the enlightenment which takes place enables one to realize the infinite and to realize the joy of the infinite, which is the bliss of the creative activity of the whole universe.